Greenwich comes for news and talk. The Lisa Wexler Show, now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600. A conversation on race in Connecticut. Lisa Wexler talks to Bridgeport civic activist Wayne Winston. Now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
And we are here in studio. Wayne Winston's just getting comfy. 203-333-9422. As we talk every single week about race, there are some national stories, but I actually wanted to begin, Wayne, with something that I wanted, I don't know if you know about, it was just in my show prep today, but apparently there is a movement towards having a formal educational process to have more people of color be able to understand how to run for office. Did you see this?
I did not.
The Day is reporting it. The Day is a New London paper, and it says that local current and former state representatives of color on Monday commended the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities for launching a new program meant to help people from diverse groups break into politics. So it's being offered by the CCM, the Connecticut Conference on Municipalities. That's a mouthful. And the Campaign School at Yale, offering a two-day training program in March designed to assist more people of color, Black, Latino, Asian Americans, Indigenous Americans, and others with the skills needed to run for public office. We talk about race every week. I want people to know the program is going on March 12th and March 19th to designed to equip would-be candidates. Just so you know, to go to the Campaign School at Yale, Wayne, it's very expensive.
I'm sure it is.
It is. It's a program, but it's expensive. And so I think what they're trying to do is bring it to people who might not be able to afford it.
I think that's pretty amazing. Now, question, does it say where it is?
It's virtual.
Virtual. Outstanding.
Yeah.
So you could sign up online.
You can sign up online. State Representative Anthony Nolan of New London calls the program an educational opportunity. It's to focus on helping people who want to serve on state boards and commissions, which of them actually pay, but some of them don't.
Mm.
Connecting people to opportunities for civic participation, so to run for your own board of ed or board of finance or zoning. Those don't pay. Those are volunteer.
Sure.
But they're really important. They have enormous impact. And they talked about how the Black and Puerto Rico caucus has grown tremendously. There are 35 members out of 151 in the caucus right now.
And
out of 151 overall in the House, 35 members are in the Black and Puerto Rico caucus.
I believe Chris Rosario may be
of Bridgeport?
Yes, of Bridgeport. He may be the president right now.
Of the caucus?
Of the caucus right now.
Okay.
If I remember correctly. This is really great, and I'll tell you why. Historically, you don't get access to those things, not from high school, not from your parents. You know, this is a place that is a great public service because being elected is a public service.
Yes,
you're serving the community. So you can't run for something that you don't know exists or how to start. So I think whether you're Black or white, you know, I think this is significant. And for people of color in particular who traditionally have not have histories of people and family and so on that hold these offices, and especially what's going on now, where you're trying to figure out the right way to do something and stay out of trouble and so on.
Yeah.
This would go with that. And I wanted to mention something about Senator Blumenthal.
Yeah.
People forget that before Senator Blumenthal, or Richard, as I know him, he was...
I can't call him anything but Senator, personally.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Senator Blumenthal, he was our Attorney General.
I know.
People
from 1991 to 2011.
And the crazy thing is, he's doing the same thing he did when he's Attorney General. He continues this. This wasn't something that was a fluke.
Did you hear, were you listening to the show? Because I know
yes.
that you were in the waiting room over there. You heard the caller who complained about Senator Blumenthal?
Yes.
Okay. So I wasn't sure if you were responding
yes.
to that. Okay.
And I just want to put perspective on that.
Okay.
With a politician is basically who he already was. As Attorney General, he was very accessible.
Mm-hmm.
You could reach out to him. His office would get back to you. That's what's missing in a lot of people, even the lower offices. And I mean, as Attorney General, when he ran for office, I could tell you, I personally was like very concerned, like who will take his place, because it was so easy to connect to him. That's why he's able to carry these large urban areas.
Do you think that Attorney General Wong is as accessible as Blumenthal was?
Well, I know him as well.
Okay.
Okay.
So the answer for you is yes.
I got it. It's close.
But, it's close. Blumenthal set a high bar.
Yeah, he set a really, really high bar, to be fair. You know, yes, really, really. William Tong, he did. And William's an awesome attorney general, no question. And the other person actually followed in those footsteps simultaneously was Chris Shays.
Chris Shays was very accessible.
A Democratic city.
Yes.
Because it was about accessibility. And what people have to understand is that means a lot to urban cities because we don't have the wealth. We can't call up and we know the judge or the owner of this company or that. Our politicians, especially further the food chain, having access to them is everything.
Yeah. Well, as a radio host, I have to tell you, I appreciate it, too.
Oh, I'm
sure. You know what I mean? Because particularly this format, because this format is designed not just to be about me.
Sure.
You know, the talk radio format is about trying to allow callers to have access to their politicians.
Yes.
So the ones that are willing to come on the show and don't set preconditions, what are you going to ask me about? I'm not going to take callers. Those are the ones I appreciate.
Yes.
Senator Blumenthal has never once said he wouldn't take callers. He's never once said, what are you going to ask me about?
Mm.
He's like, I'm willing to come on the air. I'll take whatever you can throw at me.
Mm.
That's what politicians are supposed to do, whether you agree with them or not, whether you vote for them or not.
Sure.
203-333-9422. We're sitting here with Wayne Winston. And listen, I mean, I'm not saying Themis Claridis or whoever gets the nod, because there are five people, I think, maybe six now, who are running for the Republican nod. I'm not saying they wouldn't be as accessible as Blumenthal. I just don't fault him on that ground. But I thought it was funny that Grant thought he was overexposed.
Hey.
That's the word I'm using. I'm using that word. 203-333-9422. So anyway, this is important for people who are thinking they would like to learn how people become candidates. And so you can find out more about this. I would go on the campaign school at Yale on their website and find out more about it. But these are virtual. They're from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on March 12th and March 19th. So that's a big deal.
It is.
It is a big deal. All right. The other story I wanted to get into specifically about race was, it's not a Connecticut story. We'll take your calls, too. We've got some people calling. But I did want to get into this because I don't know if you saw this. Did you see that the sole black juror on the Ahmaud Arbery case was willing to speak to the New York Times?
Yes.
And he said it was... He grew up about 250 miles away from where this happened, but he was a poor Southern black Georgia boy, and it hurt him to be on this jury and to see so much hatred. He said his mother never taught him to hate anybody, and I was wondering if you read his own interview and his accounting of how painful it was for him to hear, to just see how ugly the racism was and the bigotry.
I did read it. And, you know, anyone out there that has access to the internet, which is where we get our news from these days, you may not be able to grab the New York Times. You may not be able to grab any of these particular papers, you know, but online, there's so much there. His story is so typical, but it's tragic. And that's what he's conveying. You know, we hear of these tragedies and how horrible racism is, but hearing the insensitivity and knowing that it took the life. It's unfortunate that it takes something as extreme as taking the life for people to understand. But it was all too typical. For his killers, it was just all too normal for them. They're like, no remorse. They're like, you know, we'll film this. He's bleeding out, and they're looking at him dying. And neither one offered him
help.
They didn't
call 911. It's so inhumane. All right, let's go to the callers. We have Martin from Weston. Martin from Weston, welcome to the show. You're on the air with Wayne Winston and myself, and good morning.
Lisa, good morning to you. Wayne, good morning to you. This is Martin Mohabair calling.
Oh, Martin, you are an elected. Are you the second selectman in Weston?
I am.
Congrats to you, Martin.
Good morning, Martin.
Hey, Martin. I'm glad you gave us your last name. Go ahead. What's on your mind today?
My ears were tingling when you mentioned that program that was offered from the Yale School. I wish that there was such a program that existed for folks of color when I was running for an elected official. I think it would have been highly beneficial. I know that there's such a program for women. Our first selectman, Samantha Nestor, is actually a product of that, and I've seen how great the skill sets that she has developed in such a program. And so it really kind of warms my heart to know that such a program will be in existence for folks of color seeking elected office here in Connecticut.
Yeah, that's why I mentioned it. And again, it came from a New London paper. It wasn't a local paper that we found it. So I do think it's important because we want to get the word out. And as you know, and tell me, Martin, why or what were the hurdles or what was surprised you? I think everybody running for public office for the first time is like blind trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that. And I think Wayne kind of touched on this. You think that there is a script, and you're actually told that there is a script. You know, you do X, Y, and Z. But what you come to realize that as a person of color, especially in areas perhaps like the town that I exist, where it's primarily kind of a white community, that oftentimes that playbook doesn't fit as neatly as you would think, and so there are probably other kind of hacks, if you will, that you need to employ as a person of color. I mean, there's probably some things that I couldn't simply say that perhaps a white candidate could,
and
could not be viewed as kind of, you know, being the angry black man or things along those lines. So there are a lot of little kind of, I think, innuendos that I just couldn't get away with.
Interesting.
You know? And folks may not want to speak to that or may think in this day and age that's not true, but that's not the case. So,
you know, it's interesting that you're talking about it because I was thinking that this program was going to talk, and I really don't know what it's about the nuts and bolts of getting your SEEC application in on time, of making sure your disclosures are right. Every person running for public office must have a treasurer. And if your reports are not in properly, you will get fined. And that doesn't necessarily reflect well on the candidate, even though the candidate can never be the treasurer and has nothing to do with that aspect of the campaign. So I just think those nuts and bolts also are, you know, they're not immediately understandable or obvious to people who just say, I want to run for public office. It depends, obviously, what office you run for. But still, everybody has to have a treasurer. Everybody. Yes.
Well, I mean, I think that it probably does teach, or hopefully teaches, kind of the do's and the don'ts. But those do's and the don'ts apply to anyone, regardless of color, who's just entering public office for the first time. You know, I think there's kind of other things that need to be addressed that I hope that this program is willing to kind of, you know, double-click on and go a bit deeper on.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I went to the Women's Campaign School at Yale. It was originally called the Women's Campaign School. They don't call it that anymore.
Okay.
And it originally, and when I went, it was well before I was judge. I probably went about 20 years ago. And I had been the planning and zoning. You know, I had run for other kinds of local volunteer offices. And so I thought, let me go to the Women's Campaign School for a day. Now, nowadays, there's a 5-day program. Mm. But at that time, I think there was a 1 or a 3-day program. And it was only women, and it was designed to help women figure out how to get into office because women didn't have mentors. This says the same thing. Mm. This is basically, in the article, it says, yeah, there are some members of the Black and Puerto Rican caucus that can be your mentor, and you should ask them to be your mentor. But in a lot of other places, it's not obvious who your mentor would be. Yeah, you kind of have to be the first. So that's what it's about.
Especially when you are the first and the only.
I was the first woman to become probate judge in Westport. I know that.
Well, all right. Congratulations.
Yeah. And I remember somebody wrote a letter for me, a Republican friend of mine, and I was shocked that she wrote this. She said, I think it's time we had a woman do this job. There's a lot of family law. There's a lot of compassion that's required with being a probate judge. And she just wrote it out there in a letter to the editor. I'd like to see a woman do it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it really matters that much one way or another for gender, but it was nice that she wrote that about me, but I don't know, you know.
Well, Lisa, speaking about kind of the first and the only and being a woman, over its 233-year history, the Supreme Court has had a total of, 115 judges? Only five have been women, only two have been black men.
Yeah.
If confirmed, Judge Jackson, Ketanji Jackson, will be the first black woman to serve on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm stealing this time to kind of plug that, because that's something worth celebrating in 2022.
Pretty exciting. What do you think about that, Wayne?
She's,
do you know her?
Martin does.
Martin, you know her?
Yeah, Judge Jackson and I attended Harvard College and lived in the same house, the same dorm. Judge Jackson, I mean, I simply know her as Ketanji. You know, has always been this kind of kind, friendly, thoughtful soul. And I'll tell you this, folks, I mean, even in a pool of extremely smart students, she stood out as a brilliant intellectual force.
Really?
So it comes as no surprise to me that she is today one of our nation's sharpest legal minds, you know.
So, oh, that's amazing. You know that one of the reasons that I noticed in her campaign to become the nominee was that she had hundreds of sorority sisters, black sorority sisters from around the country, write all these beautiful letters of support for her. I thought that was really nice. I thought that was really
something. Kamala Harrison had the same connection as well, and so it's nice to see the sisterhood kind of coming out and stepping forth. Listen, Ketanji also has a stellar credentials. I mean, she's been a federal appellate judge. She's been a federal district court judge. She's been a member of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. I believe she's an attorney in private practice. And this is one that I actually like. She's been a federal public defender. I think the last time a federal public defender was on her court was Thurgood Marshall. So, you know, she's got the right goods.
Are you, Martin, I know that you're a Democrat in Weston. Are you disappointed that the second black man to occupy as a black man the Supreme Court was Clarence Thomas?
Well, I'll take the fact that there was a black man and another black man. So I'll rejoice in that and leave it at there. You know?
Okay. And Martin, just one more thing. Are you enjoying being the second selectman in Weston?
I am. Look, there's you know, good and not so good, but it's great being at the table. It's great kind of interfacing with folks. It's great kind of having a different perspective on things. You know, I tend to take a much more kind of cerebral way to doing things and procedural. And, you know, sometimes that probably doesn't bode well with everyone, but I do believe that being transparent and doing your homework, you know, probably leads to better outcomes. So I'm glad I have the opportunity to do that. And you know, I'm so bullish in Weston. We live in a great little town here, and you know, a lot of great things on the horizon. That Samantha and myself and our third select woman, Amy Jenner, are working on.
Thank you very much, Martin Mullabeer, for calling in.
Yes, Martin, thank you very much. Thank you, man.
Thank you. We'll be right back with more with Wayne Winston. We tackle topics of race every Wednesday. You're welcome to be part of it at 203-333-9422.
A conversation on race in Connecticut. Lisa Wexler talks to Bridgeport civic activist Wayne Winston. Now on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600.
And welcome back. We're chatting with Wayne Winston. Wayne, big decision this week in a Virginia court. Now, it doesn't directly impact us here, but to the extent these things will be appealed and make their way up to federal court and maybe eventually the Supreme Court, the issue of affirmative action with respect to Asian Americans and black and Latino not always falling on the same side. This judge in Virginia overturning a public policy that got rid of standardized tests for a selective school because it had a negative impact on, well, the Asian Americans said it was designed to get rid of the meritocracy of the school and that would have a negative impact on them. And the judge agreed that the policy behind getting rid of these tests was to try and create an impact of having more black and Latino students and that was impermissible constitutionally. So lots of conversation about affirmative action.
So that goes back to your Clarence Thomas.
I just asked the question.
And I'm with you. So perspective-wise, there was a lot expected because he was the head of the EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, for the whole United States. So we expected him to bring that perspective. You know, when we're picking judges, we are picking them for their perspective. You know, Trump put in the people that he felt should go, and they were conservative people. I didn't expect any of them to be liberal. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you never know what a person really thinks, and sometimes
right.
it changes. So
right.
Clarence Thomas wound up being much more conservative on things that we thought traditionally that he would do something different. And that's what disappointed people, because when you appoint someone as a president, or when they're running and people are giving support, it's what they think. But in the end, you're a judge and you make your own decision.
You have to.
And
yeah.
so he's a conservative guy. So this lends to what's going on with affirmative action as we move forward.
Yeah.
A lot of people across this country are challenging it, trying to use it as a tool to say, we don't need this anymore because there's no racism in America. We're all going to make the right decision just based upon the color of the skin. This argument here by this Asian gentleman, there was one by actually a white woman for not being getting into a university about 10 years ago. The way that it's used in college admissions, it's just a point system. It's not that alone that will get you in. So you get so much for participating in extracurricular activities, you know, if you're on the photography club or if you're doing some great project. It's just a couple of points. It is not a guarantee. And remember, diversity is a choice, because the majority of people in America are not black and they're not brown. Black people are 13% of this country. So you could run a university and not have any black people on campus. But the dynamic of a college is supposed to be educational and exposure to other races and culture and how we figure this thing out. That's why we get a lot of activism. We get a lot of people who are very conscious in college, because you actually get to find out about that kid who's in Idaho,
But the anxiety is this. The anxiety is that if you only allow 5% of a pool of 20,000 applicants to get in, that one point makes the difference between somebody getting in and somebody not getting in.
Sure. But if you put it down to that, they have the same point system for everybody else that's not black. They got in because they do poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at that vast majority of them, they're using that point system as well based upon what they have available to them. So they've made it already for, say, those other 97%. But if that's the only additional one you have, it's not like they're being flooded and they're overrunning the schools. You still have a very small percentage of African Americans, and they have to be academically prepared as well.
Well, and isn't that where the conversation gets a little ugly?
Yes.
Because that's where some white people think they're not as academically prepared.
And that's where
it gets a little ugly.
And that's where they are wrong. They have to have the same academia. When you bring someone in for diversity, it's the same ism. You know, when it became women with the feminism, they come, hey, you know, these are all guys in here. Well, don't worry about it. We're fine. Women bring a different perspective because of their experiences, just as all men aren't the same, all women aren't the same, all
right.
black people aren't the same, all Asians. But there's a perspective that they're expected to bring.
Wayne Winston, thank you for coming on today. We will see you next Wednesday, as always, to discuss these topics and more. I'm going to be back behind the mic tomorrow. You know who's coming on the show tomorrow? Carney Wilson, the singer.
Wow,
yeah.
Really?
And we got tickets to give away to her concert. She's going to be at the Wall Street Theater with Al Jardine or Jardine? How do we pronounce his name?
I think it's Jardine.
Jardine?
I think it's
Jardine. I'm going to see him on Sunday. Very excited.
Absolutely.
All right, we've got tickets to give away tomorrow. Stay tuned for Paul Pacelli from 2 to 6. Thanks for joining us today.